Doing well, thank you.
Very good.
Happy to be here. Happy to be alive. Made it another day. No gunshots. It's a good thing.
Well, apparently, where was it? Lakewood, where these things are not supposed to happen.
Oh, you
Six.
mean in Highland Park, Illinois?
Yeah, Highland Park. I mean, just like this kind of random stuff, and it's like everybody likes to pretend that guns are not a problem. The right wing loves them. The military industrial complex loves them. They make huge amounts of money off of fools. And then they convince Americans that you can carry a weapon and you can protect yourself when anybody knows that it's so random and so sudden, you won't ever be able to protect yourself. You just give it up. You go with God. But yeah, stupid people think that, yeah, you can harden schools and do other things. And the root of the evil is that it's a misinterpretation of the Second Amendment, which is about militias. But as always, and it's not surprising here that what it really has to do, as with so many other things, it has to do with racism and fundamental white fear about black people in years when we couldn't own weapons. It's just worse and worse now. So I have a sense that I'm not a gun owner. As I said many years ago to my wife, if I owned a gun, there are people I would definitely go outside and shoot.
Oh my.
No, that's not my. That's not my modus operandi, but yeah, it's complete, so completely out of hand. It's ridiculous, and we look like idiots to the rest of the world, and we are. So.
I agree, really. Well, I am a gun owner and wish that I didn't have to be one, but
Huh? Huh?
I it's just a thing.
Well.
Anything can happen to you.
Well,
And plus, I grew up in the mountains where I grew up with three shotguns in the house,
okay.
and
See
they
that,
killed.
as more of a suburban type kid, and my father didn't own weapons. The men in the military always owned weapons. My
Well, all
uncles owned
my uncles
weapons. Yeah, and so
were.
they had them.
My dad, too.
Yeah, and had my father probably been in the military, I would have grown up with them, but. It's just one of those things. I've got very good friends who own weapons, and that's cool with me. But it's like my wife says, "Why do you keep all these?" Well, I have a collection of combat knives, and she says, "Why do you do that?" I said, "Well, I wouldn't try to do anything to anybody because in those situations, the white cops always used to plant." Oh, there's a knife on a black guy, shoot him, and then say, "That's typical stupid. You know what? Bring a knife to a gunfight? Nah, that's not me." But you can, after they, what do they put 60 bullets in that young guy? And you think, can you guys shoot? What the hell is wrong with you? Your
Yeah,
frozen
can you
fingers on
shoot?
the trigger? Yes.
I
Yeah.
only need one shot.
Yeah, that would be my sense.
Yeah.
But it's like,
We just need to decide we don't need to kill our neighbors, and only one set
that's
of us
like
needs to decide that. Can you imagine? Get the conversation at hand, but can you imagine what it would have been like to try to protest for civil rights during your period if people knew and wanted to have this many guns?
it was bad
It
enough
was bad enough.
how it, yeah, and then now it's like, and I think that's, one of the questions you ask is about, how you feel after all these years. I'm not someone who loses heart easily. As a historian, things go forward, they go backwards, they go sideways, and it's hard to predict. But all I often observe is that this is clearly a reactionary era. We are. white people are basically, shall we say, I think they're sort of flirting, not sort of, they're flirting with Nazism, mm-hmm. out and out Nazism. Trump is a Nazi. Tucker Carlson is a Nazi. These guys, I don't care. Yeah, they'd like to call them, somebody was talking about that they were not religious social conservatives. Now, there's a big difference between a conservative and a Nazi. But one of the things you see in Germany, and that's why this brings me sort of around the circle to what I do, because I studied German history, modern German history, so thoroughly. You see patterns if you're a historian and you recognize them, and you, it doesn't make any difference if you're in one country or another, there are going to be variations. But quite a while ago, well, we had Nazis here before World War II. We had isolationists who were anti-Semitic as well. All these things have always been here, Klan, you name it. And they wax and wane. We're in one of these eras now where, when the Proud Boys showed up and Oath Keepers, I said, well, here are the Nazi paramilitary groups right here, just waiting to be asked to do something. And Trump wanted them to do something. We know.
And he asked them, and they did something. And now they're all whining and crying.
Exactly. And you have all this anti-ethnic groups. It's not just one. It's not just Black people. It's anti-Asian American. Mexican. It doesn't make any difference. And then you have this essentially homophobia. Mm-hmm. And all these things tend to go together in this big mix. And it's like, I just remember when I watched Trump campaign, and I thought, this guy's not normal. He's not even abnormal. He's sick. But beyond that, you could see evolve. This was a guy who wanted to be a dictator. Mm-hmm. And all I ever thought was, and you look at somebody like Ron DeSantis in Florida, who wants to have his own personal militia. This isn't Nazism, it's fascism. We need to stop fooling around, but everybody wants to, the conservative. No. Bull. I know one when I see one. My wife often says, well, what? And I said, well, the thing I guess that annoys me, and she's really good at tempering me. But I'll say, the thing that actually really annoys me a lot is that when you get African-Americans like Clarence Thomas, who made it to the top because of affirmative action, and they picked him. And I remember this years ago, it was this Black journal, and they had him on the cover, but as a lawn jockey. And they had Clarence Thomas, lawn jockey for the American white right wing. And I thought, yeah, that sure is true. And he's doing what they want him to do. And then you get knotheads like Herschel Walker, who really never had a brain in his head. And probably has CTE as well now in terms of concussions, and they're going to run him. And you think, these people, I just would like to see, after a point, are we really going to elect him? Will white folks really band behind him? I don't know. Warnock is superb. Walker is just out of it. But we've reached a stage in this country where Congress is a mockery. They don't do anything. The Supreme Court is taking over and trying to legislate, which it's not supposed to do. Stalemate and stasis. And I'm thinking, well, I know what the right wing wants to do. I think the trouble is that a lot of them don't understand that if they get what they want, they're going to be really sorry too. It's not just going to be, that's the thing with the Nazis and so on. All those conservatives who went Nazi, and they did, the end result wasn't too pretty. Mm-hmm. And it won't be very pretty here. As I said, my students would ask me about this sometimes because I would speak openly about it. And they would say, well, are you worried? I said, no, I'm not worried, because if it happens, it's going to happen to all of us. And I don't really care whose side you're on. You're going to be in trouble. And the other thing is, you need to understand, the United States will collapse like a house of cards. And I hope you like Russians and I hope you like Chinese, because they're going to run the world and you're going to be their pawn. So, you know, it's like, look far enough ahead. What's the Sesame Street thing? What happens next? Yeah, I need to think about that. But that's one of those things where I just sort of look at it and think, I hope we get through it. But I can't say I'm disheartened. There are a couple of things, as you asked some things in there that were really kind of pertinent and struck me. One is, I think in part, okay, I give my parents a lot of credit. I also give my a kind of approach to life where I do emphasize justice and I don't like injustice. And so if I'm going to teach a course in modern Europe or Western civilization, if it's Western civilization, we're going to deal a lot with racism in terms of imperialism and colonialism, and students are going to read about it. And when you're looking at the 20th century and you see the rise of the Nazis, and this country has always hated the left, communism, but has always been, and this is normal, middle-class countries have a weakness when it comes to right-wing radicalism. They tend to go to the right, and we're just like that. We always have been. And so my voice, my attitude has always been, listen, you tell it like it is. This is the history. You can take it or leave it. I've taught predominantly white students. Over the years, I've gotten along really quite well with them. Every so often, someone will give me an evaluation that says, I really hated being taught by this racist. And I have to laugh because I actually read that out once after the class was done in the next class. I said, hey, I got a great evaluation here. You need to read. It's from a young woman. And she said, I just hate the thought that the head of my department is such a racist and I have to take this course from him. And the students are all going like, huh? And I said, you know, there's only one, if she thinks I'm a racist, that's her problem. I said, but this wasn't her course, it's my course. I'm the professor. Where the hell does she get off saying it's her course? And the students start laughing. As I said, all right, so let's go back. But the thing is that I think one of the things I gained from Swarthmore, I know she's asking about books and people. I spent a lot of my time reading. I still do. I remember reading C. Wright Mills' The Power Elite, but the thing that hit me most, which is probably why I ended up doing what I've done for so many years, is the military-industrial complex, which is what sells people all these guns. They make them and they sell them and they make a huge profit. They make a profit off of warfare. I don't know, my son, who's kind of a character, and I asked him once about his fourth deployment to Iraq. I said, how long is this thing going to go on? He said, as long as the military industrial complex makes bombs, so these guys, they're still dropping stuff from World War II, Dad. We got a long ways to go. So it's like, yeah, sell guns to civilians. But that stuck with me. And the other thing that always stuck with me was my parents were really excellent about getting my sister and me to know and understand Black history before it was being taught. And so I had this idea in my head. You know, I didn't like American history. I never liked it because I'd be reading it and I'd think, well, I don't see me, I don't see my family. What are they talking about? Slaves, like being in slavery. That's bullshit. All this stuff. I'm reading this. And I just shucked it. I shucked it all off and went to European history, which obviously with groups like the Nazis, it's just as bad. Europeans are Europeans, no matter whether they end up in Asia or America or anywhere else. They want to exploit the situation. They will kill you in order to do it. They will commit genocide. It doesn't make any difference. They won't stop. But I always thought, okay, when I'm teaching Western Civ, I'm actually teaching American history in a broader context. And so when I come at something like racism, I come at it initially from the general context of Europe and global history. And then all of a sudden, when the students realize, oh, we're talking about America now in the context of all of this, and this is where we stand, this is where we're placed. And then I just say to them, listen, this is undeniably a problem. You had no difficulty accepting it when I was talking about all these other countries. But some of you I could watch kind of balk when we start talking about the United States. What's your problem? It's all part of the same large problem. So get used to it and you have to deal with it. And so over the years, whatever course I've had, and when I do military history, I've always done the role of African Americans, African soldiers, Asian soldiers. That's all part of this whole larger picture. And one of the reasons I think I'd like to think that I was awarded the Pritzker Military Prize for lifetime contributions to the military writing was because all of my books, when I did my history of the First World War, you watch how African soldiers like the Senegalese, the Moroccans, North Africans, you watch how Indochinese, what the roles are, you watch the roles of African Americans and how they're treated. And what you end up seeing is these incredible similarities, except for the fact that those other people are colonized and we're not. We live here, but it's the same treatment, but it's just internal as opposed to external. And so that sort of approach gave me some really excellent insights that have helped my writing over the years, I think, to make it quite unique, because in the World War I book, I got excellent reviews. It's actually used in some classrooms, but one of the very conservative historians who first reviewed it said, there's everything in this book from bullets to bloomers. And I laugh because all I said, as some of my students were using the book, they said, well, what's wrong with this guy? I said, well, he obviously, the bullets are okay, but he seems to have trouble when I'm talking about the role of women, what women contributed, what women do. He didn't go off on anything about race or something like that. But, you know, it's like all these people have roles. They exist. They play roles. They have agency. And so when you're dealing with it, you point that out, and some people can handle it. He was one who couldn't, but most other people, yes. And the book that I did jointly with a good friend at NYU, Jeffrey Sammons, has done very well. It is the book on the 369th Regiment, because I went to Europe and did the entire war. He did the pre-war and the post-war. I did the wartime things. And what you see is, in an amazing way, an African-American regiment that's raised by a white Nebraskan in New York City who believes that Black men can be elite soldiers, and he's going to create a regiment of them. He's perfectly happy. In fact, he wants to have an integrated commissioned officer corps of white and Black men, and he gets it. And these guys go over, and the U.S. Army wants to, the American Expeditionary Forces want to relegate them to labor troops. And when the French asked for them, the French are the ones that pulled us out and pulled these four regiments out and put them in French divisions. And the French soldiers accepted them. And this is one of the first things these guys are saying, writing home saying, you know, the only time I realize I'm colored over here is when I look at myself in the mirror. But because I can go into an Estaminet bar and people are fine with me. You know, my French soldiers, I walk around with them. They're my friends. We can barely communicate, but boy, you know, we're soldiers, brothers in arms, and, you know, this kind of thing. And at the same time, the white soldiers, half time you run into them, they want to kill you. So you have to fight them. Well, they don't want to fight side by side with you. And when these guys hit the front, they established the best record of any American regiment in the war, regardless of color. That's a fact. And it's finally acknowledged in 2015. And they still have a ways to go with the recognition of the African-American soldiers who should have been awarded the Medal of Honor. But that's the kind of work I love doing. In part, it was because of my family and my uncles and great uncles who fought in the war and were decorated. But to just explain to people who are willing to read it that it's not been the problem that we have failed to contribute. The problem is that white people have been in denial about our contributions since the very beginning, since we fought in every war that the colonies and the country have fought, and that you've got to own up to it. And you still find, I was talking in Boston to an integrated group about a month ago about the First World War and pointing all this out and saying that essentially the white ranks, the generals' ranks of the US Army tended to be overwhelmingly Southern. And their objective was to pretend these guys couldn't do anything. They were rapists and murderers and so on. It was total lies. It was a complete fabrication. Why? Because they wanted to keep the army as white as possible. And that's what they did in the interwar period. And then World War II came around and you had double victory and so on. But that kind of thing, especially in a global context, is sort of what lit my fire. And I wasn't surprised when it happened. I had established myself in German history, which was something that often led to these interesting surprise encounters when I would be invited to a conference, or sometimes by a civilian group, an aviation group or something like that, to talk about German air power in World War I. And I had one instance where it was up in New England, and I got off the plane at this airport, and I happened to be talking to a fellow who was a retired army colonel. And the doctor, flying doctors, this doctor comes up and he addresses the colonel as Dr. Morrow. And I didn't say anything. The colonel goes, "That's Dr. Morrow." The guy looks at me and I thought, okay, this is a good one. And he said, Oh, I didn't expect that you would be so young. And I laughed. I said to myself, good recovery. Not bad. Let's spur of the moment. But once you establish yourself and people read your material and they know you're good, they know you're accurate, you know these languages and everything else, then you can go anywhere. And so when I came and doing the global stuff, that hit well in the American, African American. And what has enabled me to do over the years is when I'm teaching my classes, I don't have to hold back about what I think. I give them the books, they have to read them, then they ask questions, then I ask them questions. But go ahead.
Well, I wanted to pivot your discussion toward, given what you know and what you've seen, and if you look back on some of the aspects of the civil rights movement, take for instance, any information you know about SNCC and CORE and SCLC and how it operates, given what you understand about the suppression of men from a military standpoint, because in my opinion, it doesn't really matter whether they're in the army or in the military or not, they're still going to behave in these very regimented fashions, and they're still going to push women out even though women were utterly critical of these movements and were, you know, major players in these movements. So what can you say about that?
And it comes back to Swarthmore. I think if Swarthmore did one thing in particular for me, I think I would have come with my perspective about African Americans naturally. But I fortunately came from a family of very strong Black women. My mother and my older sister, we used to refer to my mother, who was like 5 feet 3 inches tall, as the mailed fist in a velvet glove, because it was like, oh no, don't do that, son.
Don't do that.
Mm-mm. Yeah, exactly. And then when I was at Swarthmore and in graduate school, women were catching the same kind of crap, to be perfectly blunt, that Black folks were. And they didn't have the ability to respond in certain ways. And beyond that, and my sister, who's very bright and a genius, ended up being a social worker, a social work professor in California, she would often point out to me, you get away with certain things. Even when I became a professor, she said, you can get away with that. She said, but a Black woman could never do that. She could never do those the things that you do, which would be threaten someone, which I would occasionally do with one of my colleagues, something like that. She said, and the language you use in class. I said, yeah, well, that's just one of those things, but war's obscene. And so I occasionally use obscenities. But what I always thought, and it brought me back, I'm going to say a lifetime member. I was raised in AME Church. My grandfather and great-grandfather were AME ministers. My father was one of 4 boys and 1 girl. The girl became the first African-American teacher in North Jersey and now has a school named after her in it. What was then a totally white and wealthy area of Hackensack, New Jersey. One of his brothers was the first Black staffer in the White House. Another one was an officer in the Army, military career. And unfortunately, the oldest brother got caught in the First World War, wanted to be drafted, was too frail to be drafted. His best friend was killed. He may have been the brightest brother of all, but he had no fallback and ended up being a school janitor for most of his life. But within my family, what I could see was that, number one, my aunt, my grandmother might really know that well, but had diabetes. My aunt basically took care of her. And I always thought, and especially in the Black church, that the women, and this probably my mother would have helped me with this, my sister wasn't much for church, and I actually lapsed for probably about 35, 40 years and came back when I was 60. But the thing that always impressed me and impresses me to this day is that Black women are really the basis of the church. Period. I go in there, yeah, they ask me to do things. I'm happy to do things, but behind the minister, and we've had some good ministers, it's these women that really drive things, and some of them are really sharp. I mean, it's like you just listen to them, and you think, oh, yeah, yeah. So yeah, I've had interesting times, even recently, more recently in the last decade, when somebody says to me, well, Dr. Morrow, you should chair this committee in the church. And I look and say, no, I'll be glad to serve on it, but so-and-so over there, sister so-and-so knows everything about this. Why the hell am I going to chair a committee I'm not going to be a front man for her. I said, because she's the one who has the knowledge. I'll work for her, but I will not. But it's still that way. And I think in terms of those the days past, I just thought that, and I guess in some respects, being a loner and highly respecting my wife, my sister, and my mother, I was never under any illusion about male superiority, to be perfectly blunt. We're dumb as hell a lot of the time, and it takes somebody to bring us back. Over the years, I always noticed that in these organizations. And yeah, interestingly enough, one of my younger Black female colleagues here wrote a marvelous biography of Fannie Lou Hamer, which I read when it first came out before she was my colleague. And I was pleased to be able to hire her. And it's the sort of thing that that's what history kind of does for you. You realize, you know, you might have been young at that point in time, and yeah, okay, here's Stokely, here's some other male, some spine. But then the thing I always would notice is that there are all these women back there, and there are all these women in the audience, and always, and I'm thinking, and this is a later term, but my wife loves the term agency. She uses that a lot when she's teaching history, because teaching African-American history and African-American studies, that's what it's all about, African-American agency. And it's not just male agency. It's males and females cooperating, often at a time when it was sort of understood that males should lead. But then you had these incredible people like, you know, someone like Constance Baker Motley as a judge. And you think it's a waste. I've never been, even as a young man, a young kid, I think my sister and my mother influenced me so much that I don't think I ever viewed women. I know I never viewed them as inferior, but I know I was never down on them. I always just thought, and when I found my wife, the first thing I thought about was, I told you about the incident, I thought, this is someone who's not gonna back down or let you roll over her. This woman's gonna talk back, and that's what you need. And that's what my mother ingrained in me. She said, don't you dare marry a woman that you can walk over. She said, marry someone who can be your companion and your counterpart, who can balance you. She said, because you got issues. I said, I know, Mom, I know I have temper problems. I know I have to work on them, and I've been doing that all my life. But the temper thing, that's the one thing my sister used to say. She says, you know, even when you were kind of young, she said, if you got angry, she said, it was this vein on the side of your head that would start popping. And she said, and your eyes would get, and she said, all I would think was, she was 7 years old, she said, just get out of his way, because he's going to hit somebody in a few minutes. And, you know, I think over the years that kind of combativeness undoubtedly did get me in trouble, but it also enabled me to solve some issues that some of my sisters said would not be normal. I have never hit a woman or even thought of hitting a woman. I've hit a lot of guys over the years with stuff they did, and they deserved it, but probably out of line. I'll just tell you one kind of nutty anecdote in grad school, because this was in the 60s, the late 60s, and the rules were not really drawn very well. I'd come in from Swarthmore. I was on a fellowship that enabled me just to take classes. But the third year I had to teach, which was fine with me. I'd been teaching on upper bound. I was teaching guys who often didn't want to learn, and young women soon when we integrated the program. And I thought, I could teach anybody. So, but I used to dress Swarthmore style in a t-shirt, Levi's, and sandals, especially when it got warm. Our head TA always wore a three-piece suit with my guy my age. You wouldn't have known. He acted much older, with a pocket watch in the pocket watch holder. And he came to believe that he was part of the faculty. And one day I have a female student, a white female student, coming in behind me. And we're in these rows, desk on either side, a place to walk through. And he sees me, he's dressed, and he's talking with one of his white fraternity boys that he teaches. His feet are up on his desk. And just as I approach his desk, all of a sudden he swings his legs out across the aisle to block my way. And his name was Jack Knapp. I said, Knapp? He said, Morrow, you are a disgrace to the University of Pennsylvania History Department. He said, look at you. Look at your attire. I said, I have a nice t-shirt, Knapp. Don't you like it? No, no, you're not supposed to wear a t-shirt. You're supposed to be dressed up. And he's just ragging me out. He's just trashing me. I stood there for about 3 minutes. And then I turned to the young woman behind me. I said, will you excuse me a second? And she said, yes. And I turned to the student who's sitting here parallel to me, Knapp's. I said, you will excuse what I'm about to do. And he said, the kid said, yes, sir. And then I looked at Knapp and I bent over his desk and I said, come here, Jack. He came, and stupid boy that he was, I grabbed him by his necktie and slammed his head down on the desk. And I said, don't you ever do this to me again. I said, I dress the way I want. I'm as good or better teacher than you are. And you shouldn't be doing this to your other TAs. You'll be lucky if I don't complain to the department head about you. Do you understand me? By this point, he said, will you let me up? It hurts. It hurts. I know damn well it hurts. And I slammed it back up against the partition. And I turned to the young fellow. I said, are we okay, young man? He said, yes, we are. And so the woman came back. She said, I've never seen anybody do that to anyone else. I said, hopefully you'll never have to see it again if you're in my classes. But that's what my sister said. She said, you? I said, he couldn't say anything. What was he going to say? I had him. You're going to trash me in front of students? But that's where... And I did have to conquer that temper. You can't really just go out doing that all the time. But that's where my sister made it clear. She said, oh, women can't do that. And I looked at Jean, who was actually pretty tall. She's about 5'10". I said, you were big enough, too. I remember you used to do it to me. And she said, no, that's when we were young. But no, it's the sort of thing that I've encountered a pretty good amount of backlash from administrators. Not from my students. My faculty colleagues have been pretty good on the whole. And
problems at Swarthmore? I mean, did you have problems at Swarthmore? Did you fight while you were, you know, doing activist activities? You talk about people, this a lot. Did you get into any good ones there?
Actually, no, because Swarthmoreans are pretty peaceful people. The only time I had a problem was my freshman year with a guy who was a junior. They ended up throwing him out for plagiarism. And he roomed next door to us. I roomed with Dick Scheinman, a Jewish fellow who played soccer. Really good roommate. We got along very well. And this guy would get drunk every weekend, come roaring back on the hall, and he'd kick your door open and screaming and cursing. And one day we finally, I was in the upper bunk, and we finally grabbed him and took him, tied him up, gagged him, and hung him upside down in his bed and said, you ever do that, come in our room again. The punishment will be worse. We'll dangle your bed outside the room. But every so often someone, and this happened once or twice in secondary school, if you happen to be going out with a white girl, some guy would come along and warn you away, like, you shouldn't be doing this. And it happened a couple of times at Mount Hermon. It happened once at Swarthmore. And fortunately, my response was not violent. I just looked at him and said, do you think you're capable of stopping me? And it would be just kind of quiet. And I would say, well, if you think you can do something about it, do it now. You're looking face to face. I said, I'm going to beat the living shit out of you, but you should make an effort to back up your language. So, you know, it's when by the time I was 51, that's when I finally crashed and burned. And ever since then, but even my colleagues at Tennessee, I was instrumental when I was department head. We had younger Black faculty women, Cynthia Griggs Fleming, come from Duke, who was excellent African-American history and studies professor. And I was the department head when she came up for promotion and tenure. I was away in Germany that summer. I come back to a new dean, because the old dean, I'd taken over his administration. The new dean calls me into his office and says, some of your colleagues have come up here to tell me that you're going to advocate for Professor Fleming's promotion because she's Black. I mean, this is out there. And I looked at him and I said, who said that? He wouldn't name any names. I found out who they were later. But I said, that's kind of off limits. I said, I supported my white colleagues. Did any of them say I supported them because they were white? I guess not, but this is a little different. And I looked at him and I said, you don't know me very well. You just got here. I've been here for a pretty good while. And yes, I am going to support Professor Griggs Fleming for promotion and tenure. But it's not because she's Black. It's because she's qualified. He said, oh, and you're certain of this? I said, yes. And in point of fact, you never know what's going to happen in this business. But before I left for Germany, I prepared a set of documents placing Professor Fleming as to where she stands in terms of numbers of publications, where she stands in terms of her student evaluations and so on. And what I'm hearing from you is that according to these colleagues, she isn't as good as the documentation shows. So I have to presume they're bigoted and you shouldn't be listening to them. Maybe you should have come to me and posed the question differently, but I said, yes, I'm going to support her. And then turned around, so I left. I said, and you better support her too, because the department heads here have the ability to overrule their unit. And if you decide you don't want to support me, I know you're a good friend of the provost who brought you here, but I've done the provost some favors. I cleaned out one department because its racist administrator had gotten rid of racist sex, has gotten rid of a Black male and woman before they could come up for promotion and tenure. And he asked me to chair a committee to go in there. I said, we cleared out all of them, and that department now has a Black department head. I said, so he owes me. You may be his friend, but I've done his dirty work. So you think about it. He got mad. It was like, I left and I thought, oh, well. So come back to the department. When we finally convened for the vote was, as Earthen said, Palmer, 36 people. 18 for Cynthia and 18 against. And I said, well, thank you. I mean, overwhelmingly men. I said, thank you, gentlemen. And one of the guys who obviously voted against her said, well, wait, you have to tell us what you're going to do, what you're going to have. I said, no. Don't you have to read the regulations? I said, I only have to tell you if I overrule the department. But since it's an 18-18 tie, I'm just going to break the tie. And I'm not going to tell you how I'll break it. I'll let you guess. And so I walked out of the meeting, supported her, sent the material and all the material up to the dean I had gathered. And he calls me up and he says, some of this material is really damning about the department. I said, oh, it is, isn't it? He said, do you mean you would release this to the public? I said, oh, I'd be happy to if I need to. I said, that's what I'm here for. That's my job. Here's the evidence. You decide what you want to do. Cynthia was a little nervous. We didn't hear from him for a month. She came to me and said, I said, he just wants us to sweat. So I said, but he better come down on your side or there'll be a public problem with the University of Georgia and your department here will be supporting you to the hilt. So they want to pull that, that's fine. Well, finally, about a month and a day, she got her letter, promotion and tenure. She retired. They now actually have, it's funny, they've got a lectureship in both our names in the history department, the Fleming Morrow Lectureship. But it's those kinds of things. And I've always been good because as an administrator, I've been a department head a number of times and a dean at recruiting really diverse faculty, Black women, Black men, white women, white guys, they're really sharp. I got no problem with them. I mentored all of them. In fact, I mentored the last two department heads in the history department and was key to hired a young Black woman coming in from Rutgers this fall. And that's sort of been the role I play. But the nice thing about it is I can leave my department now because the people who are there are so used to actually hiring diversely. And the old heads are gone that you just do it naturally. You look at people, you stop worrying about what the race is. And you deal with it, you incorporate it. But I think that overall in my career, the things that I came away from Swarthmore believing, my attitude was I had to put them into effect. And in that sense, when you are a department head or an individual faculty member or a dean, you're on your own. And so I always appreciated being a loner because I always felt you got to stand up for yourself. And if you stand up for yourself, you can stand up for other people. And you can take a lot of risk and you can take a lot of, people used to say, do you win them all? I said, nope, but I win more than half. And anybody who has ever gone rounds with me, one of my deans here at UGA was, God, just the meanest character dealing with faculty and stuff. He seemed pleasant on the surface, but he wasn't at all. And I had a disagreement with him one day because we had some Black faculty member out there and we needed additional money. This guy has turned out to be really good. He's a star chemist and our chemistry department is really hot stuff. And recruiting him from Clemson. And I thought, oh, okay, we've got a real good shot at him. Brought him down here, entertained him. He was Clemson's department was collapsing. And I got word of this. I said, so let's get him in here. And I went back to the dean who was all for hiring him. But when I said the salary it would take us, he said, that's too much. I said, why? He said, well, it's just, I said, why? Don't just tell me it's too much. And he swore, he come up from Brunswick, Georgia. He swore, he's older than I am, a good bit older. He didn't know there were any racial problems in his generation. Now, how the hell can you grow up in Georgia? And yes, he grew up and there were no racial problems, whatever. So I just finally said to him, listen, you need to give me the money to hire this fellow. He is going to be a star. And if you won't give me the money, and I did this a couple of times later, I said, I will go to the vice president and I will insist that I get that money. He said, you've seen me get angry with faculty members. He said, you've seen what I've done. Yeah, I said, you just 2 weeks ago, you laid that guy out so badly, he couldn't stand up after you said, I had to help him out of the office. I said, I was really embarrassed. You shouldn't treat people like that. And he said, well, you've seen me in action. What do you think? I looked at him and I smiled. I said, if you ever go off on me like that, that'll be the last damn thing you ever do. And he just stepped back and looked at me and said, you're a bully. I said, no, you're the bully.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's
fine.
Yeah, it was. And if I hadn't been laughing, so it made him even madder. But I said, am I going to get the money? He said, yeah, you're going to get it. But it was like, you tell people these kinds of episodes and incidents, and you look back at me and think, what kind of circus is this? That we're performing in, but my approach was always, and people tried to blackmail me. One of the deans, when I was going out, I had actually brought charges against him for discriminatory treatment and could back him up. I had plenty of witnesses. And he sends one of my very good friends, best black friend, Ron Miller, we were friends at Tennessee, or friends at UGA, star African-American lit man. And he sends Ron to take me to lunch as his emissary. Miller says, he wants to know what it'll take for you to drop this grievance against him. So I looked around, I said, you treat him, aren't you? Because you're the emissary of the dean. I said, I hope he gave you money for this. He laughed. He said, all right. And yeah, we will not use the slang term. So we start talking. He says, well, what would you like? I said, he refused. It wasn't fair. He suggested I could not become the department head in history because my wife was in the department. But he was a scientist, and he should have known that I, as a former dean, knew perfectly well that there were department heads in sciences whose wives were in their departments. So that was not a legitimate excuse. So he says, well, what will it take for you to be satisfied with this decision? I said, are we talking money? And he said, I don't know. I said, how much are we talking? I can be bought. But it'll probably take about $50,000. So it'll probably take about $50,000. And he laughs. And he says, hey, you know, I said, I know. He said, what will, he stands, finally just looks at me and he laughs. He said, all right, let me just ask you point blank. Is there anything he can do for you? And you'll pardon my French here, because this is the language. And he says, or do you just want to fuck him up? And I looked at him and I laughed. I said, I'm going to fuck him up big time. And that's all I want to do. I don't need anything else. I blocked him from getting the provost position. And that grievance was all it took, because they couldn't go forward with it. And I walked away and thought, for years, that guy, anytime he looked at me, he'd be like, darts. And I just smiled at him and waved. But I thought, okay, and the two times they came after me, for legal stuff, for saying things they didn't want me to say, and get a good black lawyer. And the guy tells him, hey, he's within his rights. Just because you didn't like what he said about race or a particular president or something like that, he can say that on campus. But it's been that kind of thing. And I think I can't say that I had different expectations coming back south. I didn't have to. I made a clear-cut decision because, as I told you, leaving in 59, I missed playing a role in integration. And that stuck with me. And I thought, there's still a lot of work to be done. So I'm heading back. And I know people actually ask me, why the devil are you doing that? I said, well, you know, that's where I grew up. I understand these people better than they do. They don't realize it. But the thing is that that's where I belong. And I have no intention. I've had offers to go other places. The South, I've not been interested. And I think at the same time, that comes back to this business of what's going on now, that you know, you see this reversion to certain aspects of the Old South. But it's an odd mixture. It's one breath, taking down all these statues, which I know just makes some of these white people angry as hell. That's too bad. But now they're naming these forts that these Southerners named after these competent Confederate generals. They're naming them after other people. And the funniest thing was they're going to name Fort Polk in Louisiana. It was named for General Polk. But the thing is that Polk is where my son and most guys went if they were up in the Alaska area to get in the heat so they could train to deploy to Iraq and these other places. And they're going to name Fort Polk Fort Johnson after the hero of the 369th Regiment that we wrote about, Henry Johnson, who finally was awarded his Medal of Honor in 2015. And I said, I phoned my corps and I said, you know this, don't you, Jeff? He said, hell yeah. I said, I think we brought Henry back to the attention of these people. Because he was involved in some of the politics in New York, but you know, we're going around talking about the 369th and Henry Johnson all over the place. And I laughed. I said, because they could have picked some other black person, but the fact that they picked him, I said, I think we helped William Henry Johnson take his rightful place in American history and in military history. And that gives it gives me a real satisfaction working with the World War II Museum. I've been with them for 16 years. It was one of the longest serving presidential counselors. When I came on, they didn't want to confront race and racism. And the first year, I said, we have to deal with segregation. It's a segregated society. I grew up in it. My father and uncles grew up in it. And everybody around the table was, it was like, my wife says it went over like a pregnant pole vaulter, which is, it didn't go over at all. It just bloom. Nobody want to pick it up. I said, okay, all right, went home. And I told her, I said, didn't go anywhere last year. I said, I got a different approach for them this year. It's one I use in my classes. And I went back and I said, you know, World War II is about, a lot of it's about racism. I mean, look at the Nazis. Look at how nasty the Japanese were to other Asians, and everybody's going, yeah, that's right. So I said, these things we're going to deal with, right? And I said, yeah, okay. I said, well, if we're going to deal with that, don't we have to deal with the log in our eye, and that's segregation and racism in the United States? And all of a sudden it was like, ooh, caught. Did. And the director said, yes, we do. And ever since then, I had to laugh. I don't do German history in the World War II Museum. I don't do European history. I tend, as the CEO said, he said, you know something? You become the conscience of this committee. He said, you're the one who brings up the stuff that nobody else wants to bring up. It has to do with race. It has to do with gender. He said, but you just, and you stay with it. You don't let it lapse. You come around and so on. I said, well, I figured that's why you brought me here. I mean, you know, if I need to be doing this. And now, as opposed to, there's a one of me, now I've got two, one of my very close friends who's a military historian, as a Black fellow. We're the only two senior Black military historians in the country, but we've got a younger guy coming up, University of New Mexico, that we're going to bring on. So it's like, I don't like being the only one, but if I begin as the only one, I'm not going to end as the only one. And working with the National Museum of African American History and Culture for their exhibit on World War I. Those are the kinds of things I love to do because, you might write something, and you did write things for the volume, but you realize that when those curators come up with this exhibit and they realize your ideas in ways that you had never thought possible, and you're in there looking at it and you think, geez, we had a role in that. That's just beautiful. And people are going to learn from this. So that sort of made that my lifetime. And my wife always says, you know, you're like one of these characters, you get a bone and you don't ever let it go. She said, you stay. I said, yeah, because it takes a while to get your message home a lot of times. And I said, one thing I learned was at Swarthmore when, I cussed those guys out. I didn't get 5 beta kappa. I know I deserved it academically. Personally, it didn't make any difference. But I also learned some other message, which was, if you could take a licking and keep right on, in the end, you're going to get what you want done. And that's sort of in the way I've operated. It's not been in regard, I make contributions to a lot of the organizations, but as a joiner, for example, I've always contributed to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. A lot of stuff that has to do with legal diances with a federal judge in Southern District of New York. That's where a lot of these things have to be fought. Southern Poverty Law Center. We've always contributed to them. And my attitude is that that's going to continue. We've always, I laugh because the thing that saved me from having to give, when I won the $100,000 Pritzker Award, everybody was saying, aren't you going to buy a Porsche? Isn't this what you've always wanted? And I just told my colleagues and friends, go in and ask the other Dr. Morrow whether I should get a Porsche. I said, if you come out of her office alive, then I can have a Porsche. If you don't, I warned you. I didn't respect it out. So I didn't get a Porsche, but we gave some to the kids. And we gave most of it away to charity because I thought, this money, what am I going to do with it? What are we going to do with it? And I give it away to these organizations who need to keep the fight going. So, it's one of those things where I've been fortunate to be able to do what I like doing for my entire career and to continue, be able to continue doing it now in retirement. I'm headed for Vietnam and next February.
I'm glad you said that because I've been wanting to ask you what kind of activity you did during the Vietnam War and anti-war movement. Being the war aficionado, did you get started with any of that? And how did you stay out of the war given that you were that age?
Okay, number one, I didn't burn a draft card. I didn't march in any anti-war demonstrations, didn't participate. That was never my style. And the other side of it was, I often thought, okay, you've got a whole bunch of ancestors who fought my great uncle on my mother's side, was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross of the French Croix de Guerre in World War I for actually crawling out under fire and rescuing his senior white officer, whom he despised because the man looked down on them, but he still went out and saved him. He died at age 35 from, you know, the after effects of the war. And then these uncles and my father, who would have been, if he hadn't been married and older, served in World War II. Both families, as I said, Korea as well. And I came along, and my issues with the war were not so much about whether I should fight it or not. I was actually pretty equivocal about that. I thought it was wrong. I think I told you about the situation in France. I knew from the very beginning we shouldn't have been there. That was blatantly obvious to me. And all I thought was, we're just carrying on this French colonialism. They threw the French out. Damn it, they deserve to be independent. I don't care what they are. You can't tell me just because they're communists you should be in there. You got other reasons. So I don't want to hear that. And working from World War II and knowing World War II, I also knew that, and something nobody ever mentioned, Vietnam had a lot of raw materials that other people wanted, from rubber to tin and all these other materials. Nobody ever mentioned that. So like oil in Iraq and so on, it's there, but nobody talks about it as a reason. So when I came along, my approach was, if I get drafted, I will go. It's wrong. It's not the right war. But having grown up in the South, the thing that I knew, and I knew was happening, was that guys my age, Black guys my age, were actually being pulled out of college. Yeah, it wasn't like, oh, you have a deferment because you're college. They're being pulled out of college to get sent over there. And I'm thinking, what kind of crap is this? That's not right. Where's your deferment? Well, a redneck draft board, they don't care. They'll send you over there. You're cannon fodder. And I'm thinking, I was lucky enough that my parents, when they went abroad, moved their residence to the family home in Hackensack. So I was out in New Jersey, and I'm thinking, everybody in this town knows the Morrow family. I don't care what color you are. So, you know, I had a deferment, and I'm thinking, boy, you sure as luck are lucky as hell. All these guys you know are getting sent over there. So my attitude was, and I think I told you, I talked to my uncle about it, and he said, well, let's just see what happens. He said, you don't have to solve this in advance. He said, don't volunteer. No one but a fool would volunteer for this. Well, I said, I agree with you on that. And I lean against it anyway. So I didn't participate in any of that. And what happened was, ultimately, I forget, one or the other, in grad school, they did the draft lottery. And I was going out with my wife at that time, and I turned to her because her father had been a regimental surgeon in World War II in Italy. And I said, you know, I've never won anything. I went through Las Vegas once at $50, lost all of it in two hands of blackjack, which I thought I could play. And that was it. I said, so I have to warn you, I don't have any luck, and I'm probably going to get a low number, and I'm going to end up being drafted. So I think you need to know that now. We have to confront it, because I said, I don't think I'm going to get out of this one. And when they announced the lottery numbers, it was like I looked at them. I'm looking for May 27th. It's 195. They'll never get me. And at that point, I thought, well, good, I'll just go on with my life. So, I didn't demonstrate. And it's sort of an odd situation. I fully, it's hard when you actually agree with people. You're thinking, I really love Muhammad Ali because he stood up. And I thought, he's given away a career. And that's a brave thing to do. And I'm thinking, well, here you are, you're equivocating. You really wouldn't serve, but then if you'd been drafted, you would have. And you're still not participating in any of the demonstrations. And I just thought, well, and you actually had something, and there was a question about how would your parents have viewed your activities? It wasn't my parents that I thought about then. It was my uncle, in particular my great uncle, who went and did what he had to do. Actually, because he went to his grave, his younger brother told me, he said when he was on his deathbed in the VA, he asked him, why the hell did I risk my life for that evil son of a bitch? He said, I still don't understand why I did it. And I just said to him, this is great Uncle Harry, I said, well, he was certainly a soldier and he was brave as hell. I said, I wouldn't have done that, frankly. My attitude would have been, bye-bye, be rid of you, we got another fool soon enough. But the thing is that, yeah, I'm more contemporary, but I thought, no. If family is always done, it might not have been popular. But in that sense, those guys were fighting for equality. They knew they were fighting for equality. This wasn't so sure. But all I did think about was all these guys, many of them from the South, who had been drafted, were over there. And I thought, it's not right just because I actually have this privilege for me to exercise it. I have to take my chances. And that's what I did. So it was neither here nor there proposition, but I sort of waited out. I never worried about what my parents thought about what I was doing or what I wasn't doing, because they were overseas from the time I was 15 until my freshman year. There was never an issue there. The only thing my parents ever cared about was that I did well academically. If I was doing well academically, I could do whatever I wanted to do. And that was the bottom line. Yeah. And although I did learn the first summer they were back in New Jersey, I'm sitting at the breakfast table with my father, my mother is finishing cooking breakfast. And it was Sunday and I'd gone to a party in New York. And the party got finished so late, I couldn't catch the last subway, so I catch the bus home from New Jersey. So I had to stay in New York. Came in really early the next morning, like 7 o'clock. And came downstairs for breakfast. And my father's looking at me like, with this stupid grin, like, what have you been into? Obviously, the women. I could see what's going on in his head. He doesn't have to say anything because he and I share a real stupid grin when you think you're in trouble. So now you're getting with us. All of a sudden, my mother comes out. She said, where were you last night? And I made a serious mistake. I said, I don't have to tell you. I'm in college and I've been on my own. I got smacked upside the back of my head so hard. I was like, whoa. Oh, woman, why'd you do this? She said, you don't talk to your mother like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is what I did. I missed this. I missed that. This is where I was. So forth. She says, that's better. She turns to go back in the kitchen. And my father starts razzing me, just needling me like that. And he always ate oatmeal. So I had oatmeal when I was eating. And finally, he carried it too far. And I took the spoon of oatmeal and flipped it in his face. At which point, he flipped his spoon back at me and missed me and hit the wall. And I said, "Mom, Mom, Dad's flipping oatmeal all over the wall." And she comes out and smacks him in the back of the head. And I said, "Cleaned your skis for you, didn't you?" But no, it was the sort of thing that, and they were very tolerant of me. But the point was that what they wanted me was to do well. And they were very happy. I picked a woman, a young woman I picked. I really liked her.
Well, our time is over. And I would like to ask you this last question that I asked everyone, which is, now looking back on all you have done, and yours has been the one of two very independent, make your own way kind of stories about your experiences at Swarthmore. Now that you've done all you've done and you look back at and you see where we are today, do you think that your actions were ultimately useful, successful, or it's just one of those historical circles that we go on before we take our two steps forward?
That's a really good question. I'd like to that you posed it there, because as a historian, I think, as I said, I know history does not proceed in progressive ways in a straight line. It just doesn't. It doesn't at the same time. I think over the years, 50 years of university teaching, I have students, both Black and white, who still keep up with me, some of whom actually didn't necessarily agree with my positions when I took them, but who realized that actually what I was saying was correct. Or others who are still pretty conservative, they're retired Army officers, but when I taught them, I encouraged them to do what they were going to do, but to do it well. And one of them I made so mad in class because his father was a general and he was floating and not doing his work. And he kept getting, asking for delays, and I finally called him in because he wanted a delay on his final paper. I said, "God damn you." I said, "Your daddy's a general. You're going to go in the Army and you're going to float on his coattails and ride on his coattails. You're going to get somebody killed. You're not getting a delay. You turn that damn paper in on time or I will fail you and you will be here next year." He was mad. He turned the paper in on time. 5 years later, who shows up the department head's door, but this kid, who by this time is a captain. And I said, "It's good to see you." He said, "Doc, I had to come back." He said, "Because I was determined I was going to tell that old son of a bitch that I had shaped up and I am doing my job." I said, "I am proud of you." But the thing is that, you know, a lot of my students kept up with me over the years. And that's always good. I think I have made a difference from the awards I've gotten, but not so much just in teaching in the classrooms and making these connections and encouraging students to think, not just take someone else's word. Don't just sink into Fox News, read. So make decisions based on logical things. So I like to think I've had a positive effect. Now, it's positive because, you know, okay, I've taught a few thousand students, but it's a few thousand students. I like to think that people have witnessed the things that I participated in doing for the museums. And so I think that overall, you know, as I look back on my life, I have nothing, somebody would put it negatively, I've always been able to look myself in the mirror and say, okay, you're doing all right. Nobody's riding on you. Nobody's pushing you. You're doing the pushing, and you will continue to. And what I see now is these things happen. What I thought was interesting, because the class of 62, when with our last reunion, we did it by Zoom, but they actually invited me, Tom Webb, a couple other people invited me to talk about the United States today from the perspective of the Nazi era in Germany in the 30s here. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. It. There are 50 of my classmates actually tuned in to listen to what I had to say. And what was most interesting was one of my very good friends afterwards said to me, he said, you know, you said something to me that I hadn't thought. He said, this is going to be a long-term fight. This is not going away anytime soon. These people are wrong. They're absolutely convinced that they're right. This is just like Germany in the 30s, and the conservatives did exactly the same thing and followed the Nazis. And my point was that, hey, this is going to take a long while for this to sort out, and it may not sort out well initially. And he said, you know, I sort of thought this was like a one-time deal, and with Trump losing and so on, I said, No. It's going to be a while. And so I thought, and I got a lot of folks, some of their ancestors are Jewish kids who had been in the Holocaust, talking from that perspective. And I thought, you know, it sheds light on things. And so I think, you know, we're going to go through that. It may not be exactly the same. I do like to think, and it ties in with another question you asked, and it has to do with the Black Lives Matter movement and students. I didn't participate, but as someone of that generation, I am absolutely certain that the students movement had a major effect in this country. They can look at it any way they want to, but I think the thing that strikes me about the Black Lives Matter is that I'm really pleased when I see them in Atlanta and elsewhere, all these Black and white kids out in the streets for Black Lives Matter. And that makes me think, all right, this older generation may be flipping out. That's not unusual. But I always think, and that's why I've enjoyed my career so much teaching young people and then working with Black high school kids and so on, that's the future. And if you can just get a leg in there, get some points in, that helps. So that keeps me hopeful. I'm not an optimist by nature, but I'm also definitely not a pessimist. My attitude is you can change things. You can be an agent of change. It just depends on how you want to do it. And you kind of have to do what's true to yourself. But I have a good sense. I also see the same time damn conservative organizations proselytizing on campus, Turning Point. And these are nothing but a propaganda and indoctrination organizations for the right wing. And only mistake one of my students made was about 5 or 6 years ago. He was president of the conservatives group on campus. He'd had me twice, and he invited me to come to this meeting where this white guy from North Carolina was going to basically attack the affirmative action and everything else. And so I went, and I'm sitting up in the back of these white kids, and I'm listening to this guy, University of Wilmington, talk about, you know, how he should have been promoted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he gets done, and he was sort of supposedly debating this guy, but the fellow who was supposed to debate didn't show up, so the guy really wasn't prepared, and he wasn't asking the right questions. And so when they got done, I raised my hand, and back, and the fellow who had asked me to come looks up, and he recognized him as Dr. Morrow. I said, hi. I have some questions for my colleague at the University of Wilmington. University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Sid, you didn't tell us how many books you published. Could you tell me your publication record? Oh, you don't have one. Okay. So well, I don't know how things are. I know how things are at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I know how things are here, but if you want to be promoted to associate professor, you have to publish. And apparently you haven't done that. But here you are here ranting and raving that people are not treating you fairly. You need to go the hell home and write some books. Well, at this point, some of these white kids turn around and they're looking at me. Some of them are glowering at me. And I laugh. I said, do you have any issues with what I just said? And one of them said, that wasn't fair. I said, son, everything is fair. You're going to do that kind of crap, you can expect to get exposed. I exposed him. Do you have a problem? Do you think I should have let him go on and lie? And so I said, okay. Any of you have any issues? No. And so it ended. I went down afterwards and I shook my student's hand and I shook the guy's hand. I said, I meant what I said. You need to get out of here. Yeah, go home and write a book so you can be legitimately promoted. So I've had a lot of fun in my life.
You certainly have.
I wouldn't have missed any of it. It's a circus. It's a zoo, but I'm still here. And, I can sort of look back. I can look forward. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the future, but the fact that I'm still working with museums and stuff and doing what I've been doing, and I see things. I think I can anticipate stuff, and then I realize I can't anticipate it all. But I always think of my Uncle Fred, who at the end of his life, after having worked for integration, having worked like Thurgood Marshall of the South, combat segregation in the 30s, and then the Eisenhower administration at the end of his life, he was so disillusioned, he just said, segregation will always be with us. I don't want to end that way, and I'm not going to end that way. That's not my style. Yeah, you keep, my attitude is you keep plugging away. He plugged away for his entire life, and it just disillusioned him. My father was not that way. My temperament is not that way. My attitude is you just keep kicking as long as you can and you keep doing what you think is right. And you have no idea what will happen, but you can hope you did what you could do to improve things. So that's sort of the way I look at things.
Right on. Well, I thank you very much for the second half of our conversation.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
I'm utterly delighted.
Your questions were really thought-provoking because I thought,
thank you.
I never did that. Ooh, but I did do this, but it made me actually sort of look back at my life and put some things in perspective. So I really thank you for those questions are beautifully done. And so thank you for that.
I hope that we meet in person sometime soon. And, just keep ducking and carry on. I'll look for your next TV appearance or publication. Okay. And in the meantime, wish me luck as I archive y'all's history.
I wish you luck archiving history. I know how difficult archiving is. And we are so dependent on the people who do the archive. And I admire people who do that because I know it must be tough.
I love it. I really love it. In fact, I have to go. I am putting together the list of archons who've won medals of freedom. And there are a number of them, but being the academic that I am, of course, I need primary sources, and being the group that you are, I need a couple of them because two or three people might have wrote it wrong. And so I need to have some consensus among primary sources. And it's not always It's not always available. And I have to disappoint people because some people think that certain people were in your group who were not in it. I don't have any papers to say what member Boulay it was. So sorry, no, they weren't there.
No.
I have actually upset some people because they have, you know, been on the books to write their article for the Boulay Journal. And I just said, well, according to my records, I don't have X, Y, and Z. So, you know, you can say whatever you want, but it's not in this group of papers. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, it's very interesting the point you make. It's very interesting the point you make. My son was in military intelligence during the
recording stop. Recording in progress.
And his lieutenant colonel